Welcome to Murder Most Foul, a podcast devoted to exploring famous murder cases of our time. Some solved, some unsolved, but all fascinating and guaranteed to raise the hairs on the back of your neck. I'm your host, Jim Solanowski. Today's episode... Scott Peterson's Appeal. It's hard to imagine that there is anyone out there who doesn't know the name Scott Peterson, the man convicted in 2004 of the murder of his young wife, who at the time was 8 months pregnant with their child they had named Connor. Peterson was initially sentenced to death, but in 2020 that sentence was overturned and commuted to life without the possibility of parole. Most thought that this was the end of this tragic tale. Not quite. In January of this year, 2024, Peterson's attorneys, with the help of the Innocence Project of LA, have filed yet another appeal trying to win him a new trial. In 2020, Murder Most Foul covered the case with Stanley Goldman, attorney, professor, and at the time of the trial in 2004, a legal analyst for Fox News. Mr. Goldman spent many hours inside the courtroom and had unique access to both the lead prosecutor and Peterson's lead defense attorney, Mark Garagos. After all, they had both been students of his. Mr. Goldman was gracious enough to come back and discuss this new twist in the case. As a primer, we begin with a replay of that 2020 interview entitled, Lacey's Missing. For more insight into the actual trial of Scott Peterson, we turn to law professor Stanley A. Goldman of Loyola Marymount University. From October 1996 through November of 2006, Professor Goldman was a legal correspondent and the sole legal editor of the Fox News Channel. In that capacity, he was in the courtroom daily. Professor Goldman provides unique insight into the courtroom strategies, having taught both the lead prosecutor and Peterson's defense attorney, Mark Garagos, in law school. Over his distinguished career, he has logged over 4,000 television and 500 radio appearances, and now the Murder Most Foul podcast.
I was the guy who would be standing there or sitting there sometimes if we got lucky enough and there was a place to sit, reporting on things. And I'd come on to the night shows at night and sometimes give analysis. And that, I think, was the very beginnings of this reporter-analyst business. I mean, for a long, long time, you were either a reporter or an analyst. They were two very distinct categories with a line of demarcation that could not be crossed. And it was around the time I started being a reporter that they'd start asking for my analysis as well. Like, I'd be on one of these nighttime talk shows. So what do you really think, Stan? You know, the kind of thing we see today, we take for granted, but it was not the beginnings of reporting. It was something that's only been in the last couple of decades.
And by way of your law professor hat, you had a leg up on many of the commentators during the trial because you were acquainted with parties both on the defense and the prosecution, weren't you?
The lead prosecutor in the Lacey Peterson case and the lead defense lawyer, Scott Peterson's lawyer, Mark Garagos. So Rick Destasso, who was the lead prosecutor, had been a criminal procedure student of mine, and Mark had been an evidence student of mine. And truth be known, I got to talk to them during the trial and get a lot of interesting information. And every once in a while, I'd get an email from either of them asking me some sort of legal question, as I'd been their professor. And I'd say, well, you know, this reminds me of the following case. You know, I would never report that. So it was a very strange, it was a very strange case to be linked into. And of course, I was covering it with some other people that have become very famous. One who's now dating Trump Jr., a former prosecutor who was covering the case with me. And I always sit next to either her or Gloria Allred, famous lawyer who was representing the girlfriend and always would show up for these trials. So Gloria Allred was a classmate of mine in law school. So I would sit next to Gloria and we'd chat, or I'd talk to Kimberly Guilfoy, who I can't say attached herself to me, but liked asking me legal questions. We were quite friendly back in those days. I think she was just stopping being Mrs. Gavin Newsom at the time. She's married to the governor of California and now dating the president's son.
And I read in an account somewhere that you didn't always agree with Mark Garagos, his approach to the trial, especially when it came to his unique sense of humor and flippancy sometimes at the trial. Isn't that true?
Mark and I had disagreements about this. It's not the first trial of Mark's I had sat in on. He had had many high-profile cases. Of course, he would represent for a while Michael Jackson until they had, he with some of the management had a falling out. He ended up with the Scott Peterson case. He also represented Winona Ryder. I watched that case. She had some small shoplifting issue, if you'll recall. And he also makes some similar statements. Mark and I mean, I had 70 jury trials when I was a criminal defense lawyer. So I know a little about it. I don't know, I haven't done it for a lifetime like Mark has, but we had strategy differences. Mark liked, and still does, I think, like to make very broad pronouncements about the absolute innocence of his client. I always thought that was, and this is just a friendly, professional disagreement. My opinion was that if you promise the jury you're going to prove somebody not guilty, then they might, I'm not saying everyone would, but they might hold you to a higher standard than simply being able to raise a reasonable doubt. And so I always was very concerned about that. I also, too rosy a picture. Also, Mark, who's a very funny guy, Mark kept making jokes during the course of the trial. And for the first, I think that works well in a short trial. And it worked fine because Mark is very clever for the first couple of months of the trial. But I thought when we got beyond the first couple of months, the jury was getting so antsy because they'd been sitting there for so long. They didn't want to hear anything humorous. They wanted to, jokes. I mean, they were obviously, of the moment, I'm not saying he was cracking jokes in the middle of a double murder trial, but he was trying to be humorous and pleasant and funny and charming. I think the jury had some problems with just anything that was not, let's just get the damn thing over with. Let's just get this trial done. Don't waste any time on this. We just had disagreements.
And one of the things the defense had to overcome was Scott Peterson's whole demeanor, his actions while they were still looking for Lacey Peterson, hoping they'd find her alive through the time after they did find the body, and also his activities the best you can say really made him look guilty.
You do something that suggests a consciousness of guilt. Sometimes they're blown out of proportion. The police come up and start questioning you, and the person says, "I'd rather not answer," or "I'd rather talk to a lawyer." All of that, if any of those things could be interpreted as a consciousness of guilt. Well, if you had nothing to hide, why not talk to the police? But a consciousness of guilt often refers to trying to destroy evidence, lying about where you were on the night in question, things that, even though they don't prove guilt, would intimate perhaps someone with a consciousness that they're guilty and trying to act in a sort of a way to cover it up.
Then there was the very overt act of the getaway car when he was picked up in San Diego the day to be arrested, when the day they found Lacey Peterson's body. And this car was packed with $15,000 in cash, survival gear, and multiple IDs, and for some reason, a good supply of Viagra tablets.
He was trying to get out of there. I mean, there's an example of somebody who believes they might be arrested. Now, once again, an innocent person might believe that they're being arrested falsely and don't want to have to risk going through a trial that might result in the death penalty. So, but it is definitely the sort of thing that the courts have long ago concluded is admissible and can be considered by the jury.
And although Lacey's parents long abandoned Scott Peterson, his parents still were steadfast supporters of his, and at least, you know, openly, outwardly defending his innocence. Isn't that true?
I would speak to them quite often, and they absolutely believed their son was innocent. In fact, the reason why they had hired Mark Garagos may not be a well-known story. I don't think I'm telling tales out of class here. Mark had been a legal analyst doing quite a bit of work to publicize his business in the sense that he wasn't getting paid, I believe. He was just getting asked questions because he was a prominent criminal defense lawyer. And he was on CNN. And he had spoken about the obvious guilt and the behavior of Scott Peterson. And his parents saw it. And they contacted him and said, you know, you got no right to say that about our son. Our son is innocent, and this and this and this and this. And he said, well, I really apologize. Why don't you come to my office? Let's talk about it. I'd really like to talk more about it. So they did. And before they left the office, they decided to hire him as their lawyer. And that's how he ended up taking the case. It was a strange family division. I remember they started out more cordial. It was, I remember describing the preliminary hearing as I got on the air a few minutes after I'd been in the preliminary hearing to report on it. And I described it as almost a macabre kind of wedding, in the sense that you had the families on each separate side sitting in, you know, and you'd walk down this aisle in the middle to find a seat, and there'd be, you know, the victim's family on one side and the defendant's family on the other side. It could be very disturbing, by the way. I mean, this was a real, and I let me tell you in my opinion, perhaps the most depressing statistic I learned during the Peterson trial, and it was from some research I did. It turns out that the most dangerous period of any American woman's life is in her eighth month of pregnancy, and the danger comes from the father of the soon to be born child. I'm not saying there's a massive number of them, but there is a depressing number of homicides and attacks against women that take place in the month before they're due to give birth by nervous, angry baby fathers. And it's a very depressing and kind of shocking statistic. Am I going to be stuck with this baby for the rest of my life? Why is she doing this to me? Am I going to have to support this kid till they're 18? I'm now stuck. I'm no longer free. I can't see other women. I can't move. I can't do this. I can't do that. One does get the impression that that was the motivation in this case. And I speak of Scott as if he were guilty. His conviction was so far upheld by the California Supreme Court. It's not completely over yet, by the way, legally, but at this point, that certainly does look like an unfortunately classic form of that kind of horrific murder.
So now let's talk about the femme fatale, as it were, Amber Frye. You were in the courtroom for her testimony. Tell us what that was like.
Well, I thought her testimony was devastating. I mean, I hadn't expected it to be as devastating as it was when the trial came. We all knew she was awaited. In fact, it was one of those times when I had a real battle with my employers at the Fox News Channel. Once again, that's the first time I've ever told this story, so let me tell it. I was, as I often was, it was just before court during the preliminary hearing. It was a very big day in the preliminary hearing because Amber Frye, the former girlfriend of Scott Peterson, was due to testify that day at the preliminary hearing. And I was standing in the corridor of the hallway waiting for the parties to walk in, not only so I could report on how they looked, but every once in a while somebody would say something to me. And sure enough, Rick D'Estasso, very nice guy that he was, he turned to me and said, oh, Stan, I haven't mentioned this to anybody yet, but we've decided we're not going to call her at the preliminary hearing. and walked on. Well, this was a scoop. I mean, nobody knew that. Everybody had waited all day, you know, the night, expecting Amber Fry to testify. So I went rushing outside, called the producers and said, hey, get me on. I've got a scoop. And what is it? Amber Fry's not going to testify today. They wouldn't put me on because they had scheduled the entire day of interviews with people to talk about Amber Fry. And they felt that if the word got out she wasn't going to testify, it would ruin their day's worth of programming. So why should the real story bother them? So I never quite forgave them for that. I just couldn't get on. I wasn't able to report it the entire day, and she didn't testify. Her testimony at the trial was very compelling about the lies Scott had told her, and they're literally at the memorial for his wife and unborn, and he's talking about how he's in Paris, and you could hear people like singing hymns, and listen to them singing in English. You know, it was like, it was just devastating cover up on his part. It really was a pivotal moment in the trial when she testified.
Now, in addition to her actual testimony, she was actually working with the police and had worked out where her cell phone was being recorded when Scott would call her. And this was even before, I believe it was even before Lacey was found. And the phone calls, you can get them on YouTube. It's very difficult to hear. The quality is not good, but there are transcripts, and they're chilling if you go through the transcript of him manipulating Fry, you know, when he knew, you know, he had killed his wife.
Because she had believed he was, you know, single, and he had apparently decided he didn't want to be tied to his wife. He'd rather have Amber Fry or maybe Justice Freedom. It's hard to tell what it was. But it was very devastating example of motivation and an attempt to cover up that gave the jury a considerable feeling, as it did everyone in the courtroom, I think, that this was a guy, talk about consciousness of guilt. This was an example of
And as promised, Stanley Goldman joins us now to discuss this latest Scott Peterson appeal. So Stanley, before we discuss the newest appeal here in 2024, just kind of hot off the press, let's just back up a little bit for the audience and take us through how the appeal of the death penalty, how that was reversed, because clearly that was, you know, without that, we probably wouldn't be here if that wasn't reversed.
Well, one of the initial reason why the case was sent back was, and I recall this distinctly, and it was an issue at the time of the case, and that was that you can only do certain things with respect to jurors and their opinions as to the death penalty. And a defendant is entitled to have people on their jury in a death case, even though those people may not like the death penalty. But you have to ascertain, in spite of their feelings, could they be legitimate jurors and potentially, if the evidence was there, return a death verdict. So what happened was, and I don't know specifics because it was a very large number of potential jurors and a very small number of potential jurors that this was, you know, was relevant to, was that they said, we don't like the death penalty. And then they were never followed up with questions, well, could you still do it? So the defense argued that the death penalty had been imposed by a jury that, in fact, had been to potentially argue that these jurors could still sit, and you might have slanted the jury into a more pro-death penalty-oriented jury by excluding some of these people. Okay. That actually worked, and I remember being surprised about it at the time. But yes, although the numbers were small, and these were prospective jurors, these weren't jurors sitting in the box. So I wasn't stunned, but I was slightly surprised that the court did agree that that error was sufficient to warrant reversing the case back. I thought it was an error. I'm not entirely certain that it was an error that everybody would have agreed warranted reversing the verdict, but it was. So they reversed the verdict on death and they sent it back. And as you mentioned, the prosecution, after playing with the idea for a long time, decided not to challenge it. But this has another argument, which sort of relates to what we call, it's more likely to be what we call a writ. Now, a writ, as opposed to an appeal, without getting too inside the beltway here of a law school class, is you're arguing there were mistakes that are not in the actual transcript. And in this case, you had a juror who was originally made an alternate who said that she had been the victim of abuse, one of those questions that defense lawyers might ask in a case of jurors in a case involving potential murder of a husband by a husband of a wife. And she had answered no. And the defense later said, when that alternate ended up on the jury, because during deliberations, a couple of jurors, you know, couldn't sit any longer and were replaced, she ended up being a member of the jury. And the defense argued that no, she's not the fact that she was abused. Matter of fact, there's evidence in her own words after the defense claims, and therefore they would have never left her on the jury, allowed her to be on the jury, had they known that, because they still had some challenges left and they could have challenged her. I mean, it sounds like a cruel system and it sounds like a, you know, an undemocratic system, but each side is given a chance to keep jurors off who they think might be prone to rule against them. And that's sort of the issue now of sorts, that the courts so far have not agreed that that was a worthy problem in terms of reversing the entire conviction.
So let's fast forward to the end of January 2024 and the latest appeal, which is being forwarded by his attorneys and also been joined by the Innocence Project.
So now we've got sort of a third avenue, which is the way the Innocence Projects tend to work. Thousands of people have been freed based on the Innocence Project around the country since they were started. And interestingly enough, to my memory, the Innocence Project was started actually by two of the lawyers who were eventually O.J. Simpson attorneys, Barry Scheck being one of them. The Innocence Project in New York was really one of the seminal one in the country that started all these. And now we have them all over. And the theory of them is multifold, but it initially began because of the existence now of new scientific investigative techniques. DNA testing, which even if it existed at the time, has been sharpened now. You can use, you know, maybe you can do it with less potential DNA from before. Who knows? And the theory is that we should now look into them to see if they're valid, because there may be evidence, if true, shows somebody else might have done it, which is what's involved at the moment with the LA Innocence Project taking over this, at least investigating this case.
What is the typical approach of the Innocence Project in a case such as this?
What the Innocence Project does is there is no, thanks to the somewhat conservative Supreme Court we've had criminal procedure issues for decades now, there's actually no constitutional claim on appeal of innocence. You can't, you know, the fact you didn't do it is actually not appealable. You can argue that there was insufficient evidence offered at trial. You can argue lots of things, but if you're going to argue I didn't do it, that's not, there's new evidence, that's not technically an appeal. Well, what the Innocence Projects do is they find new evidence and then they request a hearing basically at the trial court level to re-examine new evidence, as they request a new trial in effect. And they have walked into court across the country on many occasions in which they've actual, you know, DNA evidence that this is not the person, the guy who's been in prison for 40 years is not the guy who did it. or we have an actual confession, you know, a deathbed confession from somebody who did do it, or this evidence was kept from the defense, even though it suggested that the defendant didn't do it and this other person did it. That's in effect what the Innocence Project is looking for. I mean, Scott Peterson has claimed his innocence for years. He's had lawyers working on the case forever. Mark Garrigou is still working on the case. There are other lawyers who worked on the original case who are still working on it. Gloria Allred, who was, you know, Amber Frey's, you know, lawyer, who was the woman that Scott Peterson was allegedly having an affair with, and also now juror number 7, I believe. She's also representing her, where she and I were law school classmates.
I'm sorry, who is juror number 7?
This is the juror who said she hadn't been abused. And she's also obtained legal representation from Gloria Allred, who represented Amber Frey. Gloria has made a career for close to 50 years now, representing women involved in legal cases, often when the women in question are not on trial or the complaining, witness. But she has done a lot of this representing of people sort of tangentially connected to the cases, which gets her notoriety. And if the person in question wants to be represented, Gloria, and wants to take a position, Gloria is a person who will get you press. She's been doing this for many, many years. By the way, the quality of the lawyering in her firm is quite high. I don't know how much Gloria does. Gloria tends to be a public relations person more than she is a lawyer in terms of the actual work she does.
And where will this motion for a new trial be presented?
I don't know where initially they're going to present it, but this will be presented at some point if they have anything and make a motion. It'll be offered at the trial court level, you know, and say, look, we're making a motion for a new trial here based on newly discovered evidence.
Based on their motion papers and, of course, what's being covered in the news recently, what is the new evidence they want to present?
There's a van in the area, which, and there was a mattress or something in the van. There was DNA evidence in it, appeared to be blood, was never analyzed. And the question is, could the defense have not only made use of that, which I'm sure they would have, had they known that there might have been criminal activity in the area? Apparently the defense didn't know about it. And the question is, would it have mattered to a jury if they weren't able to link the DNA to this case, but sort of some tangential other criminal activity in the neighborhood? And so the thought is that now perhaps that DNA evidence could be analyzed, could be found and analyzed, and under new techniques determined whether it could be linked to Lacey Peterson, and whether it therefore would have been extremely relevant and potentially exculpating, as we say in law, for Scott Peterson's case. If they could show that Lacey's DNA was in that van, it would have been a fantastic argument for the defense to make. But there's a very big if there, if there's any connection to that van and the mattress and an DNA on it to the victim, who was then found, you know, having been washed up on the shores of basically the San Francisco area, in effect, in sometime later, a body of herself and her dead child. So it may be a gamble, in the sense that you usually don't want to bet a case on the fact that they'll link it up, but it's something to be examined. I will say, I'm wondering if they have something else, because I was a little surprised to see the Innocence Project taking on the case with respect to that.
Stanley, I don't think I asked you this in our original interview in 2020. The prosecution's case was primarily circumstantial. There was no direct evidence linking Scott Peterson to the death of his wife and unborn child. As a lawyer and legal analyst at the time, you spent hours in the courtroom. Why do you think Peterson was convicted in the original trial?
I will say this about the Scott Peterson conviction. I think a lot of the reason why Peterson was easily convicted was the post-crime behavior on his part, the post-death of his wife behavior. It's lots of people have affairs. It wasn't that he tried to, you know, get out of the country, you know, maybe, you know, with money and, you know, to drive out. It wasn't some of the lying in his behavior afterwards, but there's no question that you take that all together and his behavior seemed so suspiciously consistent with a guilty mind that I think it had a great impact on the jury. The reality was in this case, in the Scott Peterson case, the very evidence of consciousness of guilt also represented his fabrications, his lies. You know, he's making stuff up very easily, a lot of stuff. He's telling lies about other things. He's a liar. He's making this stuff up in the worst possible circumstances and telling his mistress that he's someplace in France when in reality he's at a memorial for his dead wife. And so the jury was given these things in sort of indirectly that normally you might not hear in a jury trial because of the very behavior of Scott Peterson allowed it to be used for a different reason, which is to show a consciousness of guilt. It also showed he was a damn liar and a really bad liar.
So back to the appeal at hand, the Innocence Project, obviously their hope is going to be, I guess, to see if they can get a hold of this DNA and that there's enough of it to make a test, right?
They will try to get that and they will try to get it analyzed and see if it matches any DNA relevant to this case. In other words, Lacey's, for example. They don't know that it does. They're just trying to get it. And that's a completely legitimate thing, although, in my opinion, it's a bit of a stretch. And a lot of people would be really surprised if it turns out to be Lacey Peterson's DNA. I'll be surprised if they have it left and enough of it to test. It will always leave a cloud for this case, in a sense, if they don't have enough to test. I suppose an argument would still be made. The prosecution didn't reveal the existence of this van and the robberies in the neighborhood to the defense. That would be something that you could file a writ of habeas corpus on. Whether it would succeed or not would depend on how connected it was. In other words, if the defense had known this, even if they didn't have DNA that connected Lacey to it, they could have made the argument, you know, the famous plan B of the practice where you blame it on somebody else, you're blaming it in this case on whoever the robbers were. If that had happened, if they had had evidence of robberies in the neighborhood, I suspect the defense might have brought it up and a judge would have let them mention it in court, although I don't know how much he would have let them make of it based on if they didn't have any connecting evidence, any DNA. But so that would be arguable. That would be writable. That would be the prosecution kept from us vital evidence that we could have used in our defense. The question is, of course, how vital and how connected is it really? I think some people are surprised that the Innocence Project has taken this on with, you know, at this point. But, you know, they've taken on perhaps cases even less likely to have success because the criminal justice system is extremely flawed. I mean, it's just filled with people and people make mistakes and juries make mistakes and eyewitnesses make mistakes it all the time. And the numbers of something like 200 people on death row have had their cases reversed because of the Innocence Project. Remember George Bush saying that never once in the history of Texas, you know, has an innocent person been executed. Well, you know, given the fact that 200 other people around the country have already been shown to have, you know, not done it after being sentenced to death just based on the Innocence Project, I suspect we've executed some innocent people.
Well, that's probably going to be many months or many years as this latest appeal plays out for Scott Peterson. We'll keep our eye on Court TV. Before I let you go, Stanley, I know I want to share with my audience another book that you wrote that really is not connected to criminal law or murders or stuff like that, but it's very, I read it, it's very moving, and it's very personal to you, so I'd like to give an opportunity to share it with my audience.
Well, the book is... tough enough to remember the title. It's Left to the Mercy of a Rude, R-U-D-E, Stream, which is a paraphrasing of a line from a Shakespeare play. But, you know, I didn't write it like a law professor would normally write a book. I wrote it hoping to interest students who are 17 and 18 years old. So I wrote it at that level because it's a story of growing up in a family where my mother had, you know, been through Auschwitz, but my brother and sister had not made it out. And being raised as the only child, you know, who was born after the war of a family like that is basically what I wrote about. And also the sort of extraordinary way my mother survived, an amazing strength and the will to live, and in effect brought along women with her so that they survived through all these camps until the feud in a rather extraordinary way. And along the way, it's a short book. And I was able to do basically a historical summary of what those years were like, what the Holocaust was like. And there have been some kind reviewers. One commented quite literally, I think because of the length of the book, that if you only have time to read one book about the history of the Holocaust, make it this one, which is a direct quote from a review. And it's a short book. It took me 8 years to write, though. I was never prepared to let it go. I just kept writing it and rewriting it. And I remember one time I was doing a radio interview about it by someone who had read the book, because it was a book talk thing. And they said, you know, after reading this book, I'm convinced you're a very wise person. And my instantaneous and honest response was, you know, it's not difficult to sound wise after 35 drafts. Because that's literally about how many times I started the book from the beginning and rewrote it until I felt it could be easily read and understood by teenagers, for example, who themselves might find themselves raised by parents who, you know, had a very difficult time, and they can be smothered because of that, wrapped in bubble wrap. They can, that their own suffering could never quite match up to their parents. And I think, interestingly enough, some of the younger people who've read it, who've contacted me, have typically been children of Central American refugees, children of Southeast Asian refugees who've been assigned the book in one of their, you know, freshman college classes or sophomore college classes, have read it and then contacted me to say, I was astonished at this. I identify much with this book, with, you know, being raised like this because their parents had escaped, you know, great difficulty. And so it's kind of a universal story. And there's a line, Kurt Vonnegut, probably most famous book, Slaughterhouse-Five, begins with the line, the main character is named Billy Pilgrim. Billy Pilgrim's come unstuck in time is the first line. And in many ways, that was a guide for me. A couple of reviewers were kind enough to say seamlessly between present and past, because especially when you are the victim of atrocities, when you've suffered massive PTSD, even studies that have come out since the book came out show that time doesn't mean anything to you. The past is as alive as the present. It was as alive for my mother, and therefore the difference between the way she lived in 1996 versus the way she might have felt in 1942 really didn't have any distinction. They were all the same. The world around her was always filled with all of that. So, and that's why, you know, I wrote the book and why I wrote the book the way I did.
And I'm guessing the book is available online, or if you have a small local bookstore, it might be there. They could order it for you. Of course, I got my copy from the author. So what's the best or quickest way for folks to find the book?
The easiest way to find it is just look up Stan Goldman. You'll find two books on Amazon by Stan Goldman. The subject we're talking about today is the one I wrote about the Holocaust, which is easy to distinguish from the one about Herman Melville.
I would think so. Yeah. So, Stanley Goldman, it's been a wonderful chit-chat with you, and we'll maybe come back again if this thing goes back to another trial, we may want to talk about it again. But again, I want to thank you so much.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Always have a wonderful conversation with you. Really appreciate it.
Great. So I'd like to thank you folks for kindly tuning in for another episode of Murder Most Foul. If you liked what you heard, I hope you'll tell your friends. Information about the podcast and an email link that can get a message to me can be found at the podcast's website, the address being www.murdermostfoul, all one word, no caps, no spaces, .com. So until we meet again, stay safe, and for God's sakes, don't murder anyone.